Welcome to the University of Wisconsin Foundation, Bascom Hill Society Showcase Series podcast, featuring some of the University of Wisconsin's best and brightest faculty and staff. This installment features Hector DeLuca, the Harry Steenbach Research Professor in the University of Wisconsin-Madison Department of Biochemistry, and an internationally recognized pioneer in vitamin D research.
If I might have your attention, oh my goodness, everyone came to attention so quickly. Thank you. I'm Mark Lefebvre, and I'm the Vice President for Health and Life Sciences at the University of Wisconsin Foundation, and I have the pleasure of welcoming you to this Bascom Hill Society luncheon. This is a wonderful luncheon, a wonderful gathering, a terrific turnout to hear our distinguished speaker today. I have the pleasure of offering up a one-minute meditation to start things off, and that is to introduce Erwin Goldman, who is a professor of horticulture here within the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences and is also the vice dean of the school. This is an extraordinary time for the University of Wisconsin and an especially historic moment for the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences as it begins to think about itself and position itself for the 21st century. We have new leadership with Dean Molly John, who conveys her regret she could not be here today. But the school is thinking about itself in ever new ways and looking at, quite excitedly, for the foundation, the opportunity that exists at the interface between the health and the life sciences. So I'm going to ask Erwin to come up and introduce our guest speaker for today. And it's wonderful to have all of you here. And Erwin is landlocked here, so he's taking a moment to get here. I've got to just say one thing. What a thrill it is for all of us at the foundation to be working with Erwin as we think strategically about the school. The creativity and the excitement that he is stirring up, and it's simply extraordinary.
Thanks, Erwin.
Thank you so much, Mark. I think I'm going to go over to this podium, if that's okay. I want to say to all of you how much I appreciate the honor of being able to be here to introduce Hector DeLuca, and especially I want to relay Dean Molly John's regrets to you, Hector, and to the group assembled here. She had an appointment that's been on her calendar for months, and she wanted to let you know, as we all do, how much she appreciates everything you've done for the college. We are extremely fortunate to have you as our colleague, Hector, and you have really been one of the key players to transform the College of Ag and Life Sciences into one of the nation's premier colleges of its kind. And in introducing you, I'd like to tell the group here a little bit about your background. Hector grew up in the Arkansas Valley of Southern Colorado as a member of a farming family and received his bachelor's degree with honors at the University of Colorado. Became a research assistant in the Department of Biochemistry here under the leadership of Professor Harry Steenbach. And in fact, he was Professor Steenbach's last graduate student. And I expect you'll be hearing a little bit about Professor Steenbach in the presentation today. Hector received his master's degree and PhD from the Department of Biochemistry, and he directed Professor Steenbach's lab for 2 years, was offered an instructorship in biochemistry from Connie Alvium, who was at that time the chair of biochemistry and dean of the graduate school. Hector spent a year of study at the Strangeways Research Lab in Cambridge, England, learning to do tissue culture, and when he returned, he progressed to associate professor and full professor in very rapid succession, and was awarded a Steenbach Research Professorship in Biochemistry, an endowed chair that he holds even today. And in 1970, he was named chairman of the Department of Biochemistry, and except for a very short period of time, perhaps 5 years in the 1980s, he continued as chairman until July 1 of 2005, a remarkable period of service. As you'll hear today, Hector's work in the area of vitamin D has been and continues to be very revolutionary. He's been devoted to the understanding of metabolism and mechanism of action of vitamin D and vitamin A, both of which have a tremendous history. in CALS and at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Hector has also been responsible for the formation of at least three major companies in the Madison community, the first, Bone Care International, and Tetrionics more recently, and then Deltanoid Pharmaceuticals, which is all of which have benefited our college and the university greatly. He's also received many awards for his contributions. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, and he's won many prizes throughout his career, including a number for distinguished achievements in nutrition and in biochemistry. He's been awarded an honorary doctorate of science from the University of Colorado and the Medical College of Wisconsin, received an honorary doctorate of medicine from the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, and recently he was named by Ernst & Young as Entrepreneur of the Year for the state of Wisconsin. I'll also mention, and this is something that perhaps Hector doesn't even know, but he was just recently selected. He will be the 2007 recipient of the College of Ag and Life Sciences Distinguished Service Award, which will be presented at a ceremony in October. So congratulations to you, Hector, on that achievement. In addition to all of that, Hector is serving as the college's first co-chair, along with Mark Buehr, who directs the University Research Park, of a very important group called the Life Sciences Advisory Council. And this is advisory to Dean John, and it will strengthen the partnership with the life sciences, an incredibly important community to the college and to the campus, and help secure what we hope will be a great future for our graduate programs in that area. So I'll conclude by thanking you, Hector, for all that you do to make CALS great and the university strong and the whole community vibrant. We look forward to your presentation, and thank you for the honor of being here today.
Congratulations. Goodness.
Thank you for that brilliant suggestion, Sandy. Now I know why you're director of the foundation. It's my pleasure to be here. University of Wisconsin is home to me. It has built my career. I owe a great deal to the university and certainly to CALS. And so I really am enjoying addressing the Bascom Hill Society. What I want to talk to you about today is not necessarily the new developments in my laboratory, but I want to talk to you about vitamin D as a public health issue. I'm sure many of you have read recently popular articles delineating the importance of vitamin D and its many benefits that it delivers. I want to address that in a somewhat scientific way, and I want to show you the basis for our believing this. So let's do a little bit of history to show you how our thinking has had to reverse. And it's a noisy affair. Okay, so in 1919, or let's say at the turn of the century, the disease rickets was in epidemic proportions throughout Northern Europe, the United States, and probably in Asia and elsewhere, but it was focused on in these countries. And so McCollum at the University of Wisconsin Biochemistry had discovered the first vitamin and microorganic nutrient required for life and reproduction. And so the era of vitamin discovery had just taken place. Sir Edward Mellenby, being concerned that 70% of the British children and even more of the Scottish children had the disease rickets, and many died of hypocalcemic tetany, a convulsive state. He was determined to find out what the basis of this disease. He thought it might be a nutritional disease. And so he put dogs indoors unknowingly and fed them the diet that the Scots eat, where the incidence was highest, and he produced the disease rickets, which is shown in this photograph of the dog. And he had read McCollum's discovery that vitamin A was found in cod liver oil. He was able to cure this disease by giving cod liver oil. He concluded incorrectly that vitamin A cures rickets, and that this vitamin was all there was to it. Well, there was quite a bit more to the story. McCollum, who left Wisconsin at about that time and assumed a position at Johns Hopkins, knew that there was something strange about this discovery. So he, knowing the chemistry of vitamin A, destroyed the vitamin A in cod liver oil by bubbling oxygen and heating it, and yet it still cured rickets. He correctly concluded that this is a new vitamin, which by that time was vitamin D. He had discovered the B complex, and another group had discovered vitamin C, so this became known as vitamin D. Well, that was very interesting, but at about the same time, Holchinski, a physician in Vienna, had found that he could cure rickets in children by simply exposing them to ultraviolet light or sunlight. So here was this dichotomy: cod liver oil and sunlight equaled each other. And so this very strange relationship was sorted out by Professor Steenbach, who discovered that there was a lipid substance in foods and skin and elsewhere that was activated by ultraviolet light to become vitamin D. And this discovery that ultraviolet light could be used to produce vitamin D in foods resulted in the elimination of rickets as a major medical problem, because one could irradiate milk and other foods and rickets would disappear. So this very brilliant discovery he also used to create the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, and because he was determined to return the proceeds of his discovery to further research, and that's another long story. This monumental discovery, however, focused on vitamin D for bones, right? Prevent rickets, the bony disease of rickets, and in the adult, the bony disease of osteomalacia, and we've believed that for a long time. And this is just what I say. Here's a photograph. This lamp sits in the Steenbach Library. I don't know if many of you have seen it, where he made his discoveries. That's where the story comes to a transition point. And when I came to Wisconsin, Professor Steenbach remained interested in vitamin D and how it could produce better bones. And so that's the area that I became interested in as a graduate student. And even after spending a year in England, I was determined to study the chemicals required for tissues to grow. I decided that vitamin D was still the most fertile place to work. And so I began studying what must happen to vitamin D before it could cure the bony disease of rickets. And to make a long story short, we discovered that vitamin D, which is produced in skin by ultraviolet light, or we can take it in the diet, is biologically inactive. But the body has to process it, and the liver converts it to a blood form called 25-hydroxyvitamin D, which physicians now order measured because it gives a very clear indication of the vitamin D status of a patient who might be suffering from bone diseases or other dysfunctions. This compound, however, is also biologically inactive and has to be further converted. And the target for this conversion is the kidney, and it selectively hydroxylates this position, producing the final vitamin D hormone. And I won't go into the very reasons why we believe that. There was an experiment of Nature called vitamin D dependency rickets type 1, where there's a defect in the enzyme that makes this conversion, and you can cure this disease now with synthetic vitamin D hormone, which proved that this two-step process was also taking place in man since we had discovered it in humans. And so what happens is that this compound plays a very important role in mineralizing the skeleton. And I want to also say that in order to do this, the way vitamin D hormone works, there is a protein, let's go back, which recognizes this active form of vitamin D, and it acts on the genetic material to either increase or decrease the expression of target genes. And then the products of these genes, the proteins, are what carry out the function of vitamin D. So the focus is not only on the vitamin D hormone, but the receptor and the genes that it affects. So that's just an idea on mechanism. But let's go to the try to get you to understand why we focused on bone for such a long time. The reason we discovered vitamin D was the bony disease of rickets, and rickets is a disease whereby the cells that construct your bone will construct the organic matrix, the rope-like structures, in an approximately normal way, and then it has to acquire a mineral which cements these rope-like structures together and give it its structural capacity and allows then for our skeletons to function in a normal way. In the absence of vitamin D, it fails to acquire the mineral, the bone becomes very soft, and in rapidly growing children become very twisted, can result in collapse of the chest cavity, can cause death due to pulmonary involvement. So for many years, it had been believed that vitamin D functions by facilitating the dropping of calcium and phosphorus in the skeleton. That proved not to be the case. And in fact, you can heal bone normally by simply infusing calcium, and not shown here, phosphorus into the blood, bringing it in the normal range, and now bone will mineralize normally. So clearly, vitamin D was acting upstream from there. In other words, its main function was to raise plasma calcium and phosphorus to normal, which is supersaturating, which is required to mineralize skeleton. And so we learned this, but the other hidden part of the story is that one of the, and perhaps the most life-threatening defect in vitamin, severe vitamin D deficiency, is neuromuscular junction function, where in the absence of adequate calcium, you get continuous contraction of muscle being excited by nerve, and this results in convulsions, which will result in death unless immediately corrected, and doctors will infuse calcium in order to bring someone out of hypocalcemic tetany if they get there soon enough. So this is the serious disorder. And you'll see why this becomes important as we consider how vitamin D works. So the essence of vitamin D action is to raise blood calcium, and it does so by three different mechanisms. Best known is that calcium that you take in the diet, and not shown here, phosphate, will only get across if pumped against a concentration gradient, pump from the internal part of the intestine into the bloodstream through what's called the enterocyte, or the cells of the intestine. And this requires only the vitamin D hormone. It's the only hormone that activates this process. We know that we don't eat calcium every day or every meal. It's not always in our intestine, and yet we have to keep this calcium in the normal range, otherwise we'll get into serious convulsions, and so physiology is corrected, is constructed so that this problem is satisfied first. Well, if you don't have calcium in the gut, you clearly can't raise blood calcium from diet. If you don't have it there, you have to have it from some other source. And we've evolved a process whereby we can now pump calcium back out of the skeleton into the plasma, and that requires two hormones, the vitamin D hormone and a peptide hormone, parathyroid. They have to work together, sort of like two keys in a safe deposit box, to unlock calcium from bone and pump it back into plasma. And that's to prevent this serious disorder of convulsions. There's another process which takes place in the kidney where we filter 7 grams of calcium a day. The last 1% comes under control of these two hormones. And this is another source of calcium that we raise plasma calcium to normal. So this is the physiology, and it's all brought about by vitamin D working through its receptor, turning on genes that then do these processes. So to show you how beautiful this system is constructed, calcium in your blood is probably the most tightly regulated substance known. And it stays right at 10 milligrams per 100 milliliters no matter what you do. If you eat calcium or you don't eat calcium, the body keeps it at that level. And it does so because of these processes. So I have the blood level shown by a thermometer. And if it drops below normal, the parathyroid glands, the small glands embedded in the thyroid, rapidly secrete through a calcium sensing protein, they secrete this peptide hormone, and this peptide hormone has several functions. It binds to the whole length of the nephron in the kidney, and one of its functions is to activate the enzyme that produces the vitamin D hormone. And this is the calcium heavyweight then that goes to these sites, as I said, and causes calcium to come into the plasma. Plasma calcium goes up, clears the set point, and shuts it down. If you overshoot, there's another mechanism involving another gland and another peptide hormone that shuts down calcium coming from bone, keeping it very, very constant. And so this very elaborate system that we worked out in the 70s, by we I mean the scientists in the field, we focused on calcium and bone. So vitamin D, we're beginning to understand how it works even at the cellular level. So I want to go back and focus on something that was discovered later, and that is, imagine someone who's lost their kidney. They can't make this hormone anymore. They can't absorb calcium very well. They don't reabsorb calcium here very well, and they don't contribute to raising serum calcium. So people who've lost their kidneys have trouble controlling their calcium. But what we learned is that the vitamin D hormone now is playing some other role. It actually feeds back to the parathyroid gland and shuts down the parathyroid gland. This is not a calcium control or a bone mechanism, but it controls this hormone which can erode the bone. So let's look at what happens to people who lose their kidneys. So the parathyroid hormone, you can see, functions, oh, I went too far. Functions to mobilize bone calcium from bone, even if there's a small amount of vitamin D. Now, if you don't make the vitamin D hormone at required levels, you don't have it to suppress the parathyroid glands. You don't have it to absorb calcium. And so what happens is that the parathyroids believe that there's not enough calcium coming into the system, and there's nothing to control them. They expand and they produce huge amounts of parathyroid hormone that give you what's called renal osteodystrophy. And so this is one of the first applications of the vitamin D hormone to treat this secondary hyperparathyroidism of kidney failure. Now, it's really nice. This has worked out very well, and it's helped people survive to transplant, but many of the dialysis patients die prematurely. They die of cardiovascular disease primarily because of the failure to correctly control calcium and phosphorus, bringing about calcium and phosphorus deposits in heart and aorta, and result in death. And so the reason that this happens is that there's a very narrow range. The vitamin D hormone itself, its primary purpose is to raise serum calcium. And it does so when you give it in therapy, but it does too much of it. And so although you raise calcium, you endanger the patient to calcification. And you have to give this hormone to suppress the parathyroid glands. So now we've devised a new form of vitamin D that's in development where this vitamin D compound has lost, or we've synthesized out, its ability to raise blood calcium. So it takes huge amounts to raise blood calcium, but only it acts very much like the native hormone to suppress parathyroid. So this really, when it comes into existence, when it passes through the FDA system, will provide these patients with a huge window where they won't get calcification of their heart and aorta, but can control their parathyroid glands. But again, we're working with a calcium disease. Postmenopausal osteoporosis, a major disease, one which affects 25 million Americans. It's only 15% of them are treated because there really isn't a very good treatment for osteoporosis at this stage. And what this disease is a loss of bone mass, both the honeycombing of bone within the trabecular or the backbone and the long bones, and the shaft of the bones become thin as well. And when they become very thin, then fractures result either by some trauma or sometimes just collapse by weight of the body on the vertebral bodies of the spine, and you get people who are losing height because their spinal column is collapsing. So we've been working very hard at devising a vitamin D compound that will cause the synthesis of new bone. Because the vitamin D hormone has about 10% of its activity devoted to synthesizing new bone. This is quite apart from depositing mineral in bone. This is making the cells elaborate more organic matrix, more bone. And so we tested this new substance on osteoblasts isolated from normal human beings that had undergone bone surgery. And we treated these osteoblasts in culture with the native vitamin D hormone. We used even huge amounts, and only a small amount of mineralization took place, or new bone formation. However, this new form of vitamin D causes huge synthesis of organic matrix and mineralized bone in culture. So it did show great promise, but in culture is quite a ways from in the body. So we then treated postmenopausal rats, so to speak. We ovariectomized aged female breeder rats, which we obtained from Sprague Dowley, and they lose an enormous amount of skeleton just by having many litters, but then the added insult by taking away their estrogen by ovariectomy, they lose the rest of their bone, and so the green parts are the the actual mineralized bone left in these animals. We then treated them with this new form of vitamin D with just enough so that the calcium just began to move. And at the end of 20 weeks, you can see the skeleton has been largely restored. So this is now in phase two trials in people. We don't know if it works in people, but we're going to know within a year. So all of this is devoted to bone. What's all of this in the newspapers about vitamin D doing so many great things, such as reducing risk of cancer? Well, when the receptor, the protein that recognizes the vitamin D hormone, was discovered, we began to find this receptor, as you would expect, in the intestine that responds to the vitamin D hormone, the osteoblast that makes bone, we just talked about that, and the kidney cells that line the nephron. Now we begin to see it in the parathyroid. And remember, we suppressed the growth of the parathyroid. Remember, we didn't know we were doing that. We suppressed synthesis of the parathyroid hormone. So this is a non-bone action. And now we find it in the skin. Interesting, how could skin affect bone? The immune cells, it's found in colon, pancreas, stomach, pituitary, ovary, prostate. It's not found in liver, it's not found in skeletal muscle. There are cells where it's not found, but it is found in many tissues, and we begin to think it has to be there for a purpose. So Dr. Suda in Japan discovered that when you add the vitamin D hormone to promyelocytes, these are HL60 or cancer cells, these cells stop growing and they differentiate into a functional cell called a monocyte. And these now are the precursors of the giant osteoclast. It does get back to bone, but here we have a function of vitamin D not related to calcium and not related to bone. We're stopping growth of malignant cells in culture, which excited a lot of people thinking that vitamin D compounds might be used to treat cancer. So far, that's not yet come to pass, although there are plenty of experimental work going on in that direction. All right, so what else do we know? Well, what about skin? The fact that you can cause skin proliferation, the fact that you can inhibit proliferation of malignant cells, and also you can inhibit proliferation of the keratinocyte, the primary cells of skin, led scientists, medical scientists, to use the vitamin D hormone and analogs to treat psoriasis. And in fact, it works. Dovonex has been on the market for almost 17 years. It's certainly a non-bone function. It's applied topically and not orally, but there is some evidence that vitamin D can also reduce psoriasis when given orally. It's not been absolutely proved. Now let's talk about the immune system. There are a number of autoimmune diseases and inflammatory diseases that we know of. And one of the major ones is multiple sclerosis. A postdoc of mine, Margarita Contorna, came to my group in 1990, and she was interested in whether we could do anything with autoimmune diseases, because we had found that vitamin D compounds could inhibit what's called delayed hypersensitivity, could definitely inhibit an inflammation reaction. So she picked up the model of multiple sclerosis, which is a black 10 mouse, which if you inject in them a myelin basic protein, a protein that comes from the myelin sheath that encircles all nerve cells, they will develop a weakness. I'm going to go back to They develop first a tail weakness. I seem to have trouble with this. And progressively, they will lose function of their forelimbs. Then they'll get a relapse. Their forelimbs will look okay, their hind limbs, and eventually they become immobilized and have to be sacrificed. This is called experimental autoimmune encephalomyelitis, which is considered the best model of multiple sclerosis. So if you now give these animals the vitamin D hormone, you can completely block this disease. Okay, so this is non-bone function, but when you give the vitamin D hormone, you have to give it in sufficient amounts that it drives the blood calcium into an unacceptable range. So although we can prevent the disease in mice, you cannot use that compound to treat human beings because you will do more damage than good. But it tells us that the vitamin D hormone is a factor in this disease. There are other autoimmune diseases, type 1 diabetes, the development of insulin dependence early on. And this is a genetically controlled disease that affects really millions of Americans that are living depending upon insulin. There's a model of this disease called non-obese diabetic mice. And we've used this again to test whether, in fact, vitamin D hormone can be used to treat or prevent this disease. And in fact, the very same is true with experimental autoimmune encephalomyelitis in the case of type 1 diabetes in this model. If you make the animals vitamin D deficient, this is a vitamin D sufficient animal. If you make them deficient, they develop the disease much earlier and a higher percentage of them. So dietary vitamin D is a factor in development of type 1 diabetes. Okay, so the same is true of rheumatoid arthritis. The same is true of lupus. And there are several other autoimmune diseases which result from inflammatory attack by the T cells and the macrophages that destroy your normal tissue. So can we treat these diseases with the vitamin D hormone? No, not yet, because of the hypercalcemia. But we are developing analogs that we got rid of the calcemic effect, but we have to be sure that they still retain the ability to suppress the immunes, the relevant immune components. So the answer is of treatment is not in, but let's look at the implication of this. I mentioned cancer and the fact that vitamin D compounds will suppress growth of cancers in vitro. There's also evidence that that occurs in vivo. So why is there some tremendous interest in vitamin D status and prevention of cancer? The answer starts with first solar radiation and its relationship to the incidence of cancers. This happens to be breast cancer. The blue represents low incidence. The red represents very high incidence. And if you look at this globally, you'll see the same relationship. The lines indicate the degree of solar radiation reaching these patients or subjects. The lower the exposure, the less vitamin D in your blood. And the reasoning is that vitamin D is protective against breast cancer. And in fact, evidence is that people running their blood levels of vitamin D, 25-hydroxy-D, of about 80 micrograms per milliliter, we normally run 30, and in Wisconsin in the winter, we may run as low as 10, You get up to the 80, there appears to be by, again, this is epidemiologic studies that indicate that you can reduce the risk of breast cancer by 50%. And this shows you what this particular study, which came from Australia, shows it to be somewhere around 50% a lower risk when you're running a blood level of 48 nanograms per milliliter. How about colorectal cancer is another one. The vitamin D hormone has been shown to very much affect a cytochrome 3A4, which is a cytochrome that destroys unwanted xenobiotics that come into the gut. So there is some evidence that on a biochemical basis that it induces enzymes that destroy some of the carcinogens that we face in our daily lives. That may be one of the mechanisms. But here, look at the epidemiological study that shows, again, that the risk of colorectal cancer is related to solar radiation. High risk, low risk. And the same is true if you do a worldwide study where data are available. Prostate cancer. Again, I want to show you that, again, the incidence of prostate cancer is inversely related to vitamin D status. Multiple sclerosis that we talked about, here is a beautiful example of relationship to solar irradiation. There are some exceptions to this. There's very low incidence among people living very high in the Alps, because when they're very high in the Alps, you get much higher ultraviolet irradiation, higher production of vitamin D. Another place is in around the fjords of Norway, where the residents eat an awful lot of fish, including fish liver oil, and that's the only known source other than synthetic sources of vitamin D. And that tells us vitamin D is actually not a vitamin. It's actually a prohormone that's normally made in our skin, because you rarely find it in a diet. You find it in such strange places as fish liver oils that most of us don't eat unless your mothers are forcing it down your throat, like I did when I was a kid. Okay, so that's the basis for the current public health move to increase the recommended daily allowance for vitamin D. You can completely prevent rickets and osteomalacia with 400 units of vitamin D per day. And that's what's in your vitamin capsules. In fact, you can probably prevent rickets with as little as 20 units per day. But that's the bone disease. What we're talking about now is the risk of more degenerative diseases which come later in life. And the evidence now is that we are taking insufficient amount of vitamin D to bring our blood levels to a point where we have maximum protection against the cancers that I just talked about, maximum protection against autoimmune disease. Now, you have to remember that vitamin D is a dangerous compound. It is potentially toxic. There are stories, I'm sure you've read, of people who have been poisoned by improper fortification of milk. We were supposed to have 400 units per quart, but the way some dairies had used to fortify is that someone would stand at the top of a tank and dump a bottle of vitamin D concentrate, and then it would be bottled. Well, some bottles would have 10,000 units and other bottles would have none. And there was a lady in Boston, I was on this particular case, that died of hypervitaminosis D because she happened to be the unfortunate one of getting milk which came off the top of one of those mixtures. It is, we don't know where it begins to be toxic is the major problem. There is no good study that defines where does the first 1% of our population begin to run hypercalcemia and calcification of their kidneys and heart. There's a recent study that came out that said you can take 10,000 units a day for 6 months. That's fine for 6 months. But vitamin D is a fat-soluble material, and when what you don't use gets put into the lipid depots. And I've seen cases where people are put into toxicity by losing their body fat, and the vitamin D is liberated and becomes in excess and causes hypervitaminosis D. So if a little is good, more is not necessarily better. So we have to define where we can go safely now. So I don't know where that upper limit is. I do know that we can safely go to 2,000, maybe 4,000, maybe 5,000, and maybe we can go beyond that, but I think the NIH has to foster a study where we treat patients with different levels of vitamin D for a period of at least 2 years to find out and define what is a level where you will not be in any danger of intoxication. There is enough information in the literature to tell us that I am targeting myself for this level of vitamin D. And that will give you a blood level probably of about 60 nanograms per milliliter. So do not take more than that unless a doctor is prescribing it for a specific disease or unless some doctor is willing to monitor you and advise you whether you should come off of it or not. So the conclusions are that vitamin D has turned out to be an extremely fertile area of investigation. It looks like we're going to get new therapies out of this molecule that are specifically targeted for osteoporosis, for bone disease of kidney failure, and psoriasis. And we think that we're going to eventually be able to devise vitamin D compounds that can be used in autoimmune disease. The problem is we don't know exactly the molecular mechanism of how it works in suppressing the inflammatory response. And so we haven't been able to measure that and decide which form of vitamin D works best there. But as we start getting there, we'll be able to devise vitamin D molecules that will be able to be used for therapy. So that's the long-range plan. But this is, I think, the take-home message. There's very little doubt that vitamin D is a beneficial factor in reducing our risk of cancer and autoimmune disease. And that, to me, justifies our increasing our intake to a place where we think it's safe, and we're going to be pushing to get a study to know how far up we can go before we turn it loose on our population. So that's the message I want to leave with you. If there's any question, I'd be glad to try to answer. The question is, vitamin D is offered in two forms in the grocery store and the drugstore. One's in an oil capsule, one is in a dry pill. Is there any difference? The answer is no. You can absorb it from either one of those two forms. Vitamin D is a remarkably bioavailable. I think it's at least 80% absorbable. The question is, can you take too much calcium with vitamin D, or does the body throw off what it doesn't need? There are two answers to that question. The first is, you're right. You can have a variable diet and your body can adjust to it. However, you can take too much calcium. I think a Woman's Health study just recently showed that if you get too high in calcium, there is some risk of stone formation in the kidney because you're having to work to get rid of it. Most of it isn't absorbed and goes through it, and it tends to be constipatory. That's another factor. So vitamin D does need calcium to build bone, but it's not needed for these other functions, and it can work against you if you're battling against rising serum calcium. So take a normal amount of calcium, about 1,000 milligrams a day, and your vitamin D supplement, you should be fine. The question is there any difference between sunlight exposure and taking a vitamin D pill? Yes, there's quite a difference. No one has ever been poisoned of vitamin D by sunlight exposure. Usually, if you're going to suffer from sunlight exposure, it's for other reasons. You're going to get sunburned, you're going to get all kinds, there's a danger of cancer. That's why I'm not recommending that you all go out and expose yourself to sun to get your vitamin D. There's a risk to that. In fact, the dermatologists believe that you shouldn't expose yourself to significant amounts of ultraviolet light because of the danger of skin cancer. But we have a nice alternative, oral vitamin D. You're not exposed to sunlight. So, and the other interesting thing is you can be poisoned with oral vitamin D. Okay, by too much of it. So that's the long and short of both routes of acquisition of vitamin D. Question?
Why does the knee play a role in seasonal?
Okay, the question is, does vitamin D play a role in seasonal disorder depression? There are some papers that are just coming out. It's debatable whether there's a vitamin D receptor in neural tissue. There are some cells that have it and most of them don't. So I'd say the story's not in on that. There's no evidence yet that is compelling that makes me believe it, but we have to keep an open mind. It hasn't been studied that much. Yeah, the question is the forms of vitamin D which you take in. There are two forms available. Historically, vitamin D2, which is made from the plant sterol ergosterol, was the primary form of vitamin D available just for cost of production. Now vitamin D3, which is the form our skin makes, is just as cheap and just as available. If you look at curing rickets in animals and in people, D2 and D3 are equal. Are D2 and D3 equal in preventing these degenerative diseases? Nobody has a clue on that. So I'd say that D3 is the one to take if you have a choice, because that's what your body makes and that's what is being measured when the studies that show blood levels relationship to incidence of disease, they're measuring vitamin D3. So I'd say don't rule out vitamin D2, but you have a choice, take D3. Yes, the question is there any study on type 2 diabetes and vitamin D? To my knowledge, I have not seen one. That is a little different kind of diabetes. It's not destruction of the islet cells, which is the inflammatory process. So right now, there's no evidence to say that there's any relationship, as far as I know. Question?
Has anybody run an experiment to say that people over 95 who presumably have been resistant to a lot of conditions, and see whether their serum blood levels are a D
Well, no. The question is, has anybody done a study of blood levels of people above 95, right? I think that's a sampling problem. Are you volunteering, Milt? There are a lot of studies of people that are in their 80s and 90s, and their blood levels are generally low because they've been consuming low amounts of vitamin D. And many of them are indoors in nursing homes, and they don't get sunlight. So would they be better protected with more vitamin D? The answer is not known. The question are there any studies that relate evolutionary processes to vitamin D? Is that what you mean? Okay. The answer is yes. There's an awful lot of work on the evolution of the vitamin D system that we know of in mammals today. For example, frogs, which are the amphibians, they require vitamin D. In fact, they deposit calcium in lime sacs, a completely different mechanism. And it's primarily been studied in relation to bone. And as you get to bony fish, that's very interesting because the vitamin D system evolved to what we know it as animals emerged from seawater. Seawater has 1 millimolar ionized calcium, which is our blood level of ionized calcium. So there was no need for vitamin D to utilize calcium out of sea. So vitamin D is believed to have evolved as an anti-xenobiotic substance, because the vitamin D receptor appears very early in evolution, and the cytochrome 3A4 induction appears early, but the calcium system begins to appear as the animals emerge from the sea into fresh water, where they need to now acquire calcium avidly, and they need to store it, and yet they need to make it available for their nerves and muscles. As they got onto the land, it even got more of an acute process, because now you needed a stronger skeleton to support the functions on land. And yet you needed to really utilize calcium whenever it came into the environment. So there is a very large body of information on evolution of the calcium system, the bone system, and we're starting to learn more about the other functions of vitamin D and when they evolved. But we don't know the answers to most of those questions. The question is, does grapefruit have any effect on the metabolism of vitamin D? I don't know. I eat grapefruit quite a bit. Yeah, definitely. High blood pressure medication, you usually don't want to consume grapefruit, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they do get better. Now, whether that affects the serotonin system or not, I'm not sure. But in my own experience, and people who, like in California, where you think they get a lot of sun, the studies that they've done is that these people are living inside all day, like we are here today, and missing out on our sun. And I've read all your papers, and this is a nice presentation, because it helps me to hear you.
Yes, that's right. 10 to 15 minutes of summer sun on hands and face will give you enough vitamin D to prevent rickets and osteomalacia.
Yeah.
but it doesn't say anything about the other disorders.
No, that's
and as far as light-related dysfunction, remember, light can have other effects besides production of vitamin. We focus on vitamin D because we know about it. There's the pineal gland system that still is, you know, no-no land, and there could be other things that light does that besides vitamin D. So we have to keep that in mind. The best way is to have blood 25-hydroxy-D level measured. But what are the symptoms of excess vitamin D? Itchiness of skin, lack of appetite, excessive urination. Those are the symptoms that are associated with hypercalcemia. One more question. Now, the question is, does skin pigmentation have an influence on vitamin D production in different places? The answer is yes. Black people are much less efficient at converting vitamin D, converting their 70-hydrocholesterol to vitamin D. And in fact, that was a theory on evolution of the races, that only the light-skinned people could migrate north and south and get enough sunlight and vitamin D to produce functional bones. The people that stayed in the equator were protected from too much sunlight and sunlight damage. So it's a theory. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this installment of the Bascom Hill Society Showcase Series podcast. For more information on this and other topics, please visit the University of Wisconsin Foundation homepage at www.uwfoundation.wisc.edu.